Hello and welcome to another episode of Pakistanomy. My name is Uzair Yunus, and for regular listeners of this podcast, you kind of would be wondering and relating to the fact that I've raised this topic a number of times on broader economic conversations, which is stunting and nutrition and access to good nutrition for Pakistan's next generation. And in previous econ-heavy conversations, we've talked about how productivity, the aspirations of Pakistan's next generation, Pakistan being a young country, how all of this ties into the emergency related to stunting and malnutrition in Pakistan, and how to solve for the economic and productivity crisis, we also need to look at human development and public health issues, in particular stunting. So today, I have the honor and privilege to have one of the foremost experts on this topic, Dr. Ghazala Mansouri, who is a lead economist for the South Asia region and a global lead for the welfare impacts of climate change at the World Bank. Her work, which is at the intersection of research and policy, has been published in leading journals in economics and development, including the American Economic Review, the Review of Economic Studies, and the Review of Economics and Statistics. So in that sense, Dr. Mansouri is like the perfect guest for Pakistanomy, because we are quite wonky. We go into the very details of topics and love to have economists and experts in their fields, you know, tell us what is going on, why things are important. And this in particular, this topic is really, really critical for a country like Pakistan, because let's be honest, if Pakistan's next generation is not nourished properly, is suffering from stunting and malnutrition, is suffering from all sorts of other issues, if mothers in Pakistan are unable to take care of their next generation in the way that they want, then it is what is, you know, often both my siblings are psychiatrists, often refer to this as generational trauma. And that generational trauma is not good for any society. It has long, long impacts moving forward. So we'll jump into all of that. Dr. Mansouri, first of all, thank you so much. You've been planning this conversation for a long time, and I'm excited that we are finally having this discussion.
Thank you, Zair. I'm really very happy to be here today. It's extremely timely. And yes, as you say, this conversation, these conversations need to happen on this topic. So I'm really looking forward to our chat today.
So I want to jump in, right? You've done research and you have the data and you understand the scale and nature of this challenge. I look at statistics, and I've shared these statistics in my articles, in other conversations. Dr. Atif Mia a lot has started referring to it whenever he talks about Pakistan, right? A macroeconomist talking about stunting, right? That's how, for those of us who look at the data, the challenges, but we don't really understand it. In fact, I remember when I met you at the Pakistan conference in November last year, in your panel, you made this remark that I noted it down, right? This is not just a food issue, it's actually a water issue. I remember that fact. I think many people don't realize that who follow this subject. So help us understand the scale and nature of this problem and what are the main causes for it.
Great. So let's first start by talking about what exactly is stunting, right? Very often people, you know, you hear the word stunting and people think, you know, somehow there's a height deficit, you know, things like, so there is a height deficit, but that's rather mild relative to your sort of genetic potential, right? We all have different genetic potential for height, which we inherit from our parents, and you might have a deficit of between 2 and 4 inches, let's say, right? And that might be a result of stunting. However, the main thing that's going on with stunting is that it's a chronic condition that actually damages the child's growing brain. So all of the action on stunting really happens between pregnancy and the first 2 years of life. This is first of all, very important to remember. We're really talking about that 1,000 days that we've all heard about by now, I think, or many of us have been hearing about, right? What is that 1,000 days? Gestation to the first 24 months of life. What is happening in this time period? 80% of brain development occurs in this time period. And the brain is an incredibly hungry organ all our lives long. It remains hungry even into adulthood. It takes a lot of the caloric intake, the energy intake that we take is used by our brain. But in children, the vast bulk of what you're intaking is going to directly towards brain growth. All of the neural cell development occurs in this time, right? So if the brain is deprived of nutrients at this stage, it just doesn't form the right neural connections. It is cognitively damaged. It is almost entirely irreversible, right? Children are also born stunted. So if the mother was in severe deficit during gestation or because of her history, a child can be born stunted. And usually we look at head circumference for that, right? So the important thing to remember is that none of your genetic height potential is actually being realized in the first 24 months of life. At that stage, every single baby, if it's human, grows at exactly the same rate, right? Which is why we can use indicators like height for age or weight, to detect malnutrition or arm circumference. Because given the right nutrients, given the right environment, every human child will grow at more or less roughly the same pace and rate up to age two. After that, of course, as you grow older, your genetic factors start kicking in. So this is important to understand. So it damages the architecture of the brain. At the same time, it damages the child's immune system. And we'll talk in a minute about why. Why is the brain damaged? Why is the immune system damaged? What is doing that? But it also permanently damages your immune system. That makes for a weak child. That child is physically weak as well. That child is susceptible to all manner of diseases in childhood and then into all forms of chronic diseases in adulthood, right? So it's a lifelong health challenge we are creating, right, in this individual, right? What does that mean, essentially? That child is going to have a really hard time with physical capacity, will be struggling with illness, will have a really hard time with learning because of the cognitive deficits, will not attain schooling to the degree that they should. And in adulthood, there's fairly good data now showing that they have lower earnings, lower labor productivity. And by the way, just off the bat, combine that with what's happening with climate change. And Pakistan is one of the regions of the world that is slotted to have the greatest increase above average in the increase in heat, right? In temperature. Now, in high temperatures, in any case, labor productivity falls. But if you have a weak person, if an immune compromised, physically weak individual at high heat, right, their labor productivity will collapse, actually, right? So this is stunting, okay? It is a very serious business. It is not something we can afford to get to it when we get to it. Often, people sometimes think, other things are more important. Let's get our macro in shape and whatever. And my point is, you can do whatever you want, but essentially this thing is going to severely limit Pakistan, right? It's also intergenerational. You said it's a generational trauma. Actually, it's an intergenerational trauma because a stunted mother has a very high likelihood of having a stunted child. That child could well be stunted at birth if that child in gestation faces the same circumstances the mother faced growing up, right? And so this is really a very serious issue. So I can come to what factors, what do we need to do, or what are the driving factors? Let's talk first about that. What causes stunting?
But right? if before you go to the what causes, there's a couple of things I want to jump into, right? I mean, I often, in the mainstream, in terms of people who generally understand stunting, but again, aren't as deep, anywhere near as deep as you have been on this topic, have this view that, one of the ways to fix it is nutritional programs at school. What you're describing, I want to underline that point that you got talked about the first 1,000 days. Nutritional programs are important, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But by then, it's too late for the intervention. The intervention has to happen, and we'll get to what interventions, but I want to underscore, it's a story of the first 1,000 days for the mother and the child.
Yeah, this is absolutely vital that people understand this, right? Because that it's a done deal at age two, more or less a done deal, right? When we say that there's a window of opportunity, that window of opportunity begins at gestation and closes at 24 months, right? So school nutritional feeding programs, all of this is good because children who are hungry can't learn, right? But it will not affect child stunting. That cognitive damage is done. The immune dysfunction exists. In fact, there's very good data now showing that excess calories beyond age two will mostly lead to obesity more than anything else, right? So that child will be stunted, but that child will also face, even with normal caloric intake, can face obesity. There's good data showing that historically famines at some point in history have made entire populations predisposed to obesity and diabetes without over-ingesting it, right? So this is serious business. That first deficit is very serious. So I really do think that what you've raised is, and you've re-emphasized this absolutely critical point. Relatedly, and now we can move with that if that's okay, into the factors. If you talk to 10 people just like that about stunting and use the word malnutrition, which is often used in this context, the first thing that almost everybody thinks about is people are not getting enough to eat.
या पीपल उर्दू में
भूख
कहते हैं खुराक सही
ना
नहीं
है,
थी, भूख
खुराक
थी
ही
और
नहीं,
खुराक
भूख
सही
है,
नहीं है।
भूख है, राइट? कि बहुत भूख है हमारे मुल्क में, बहुत भूख है, अभी तक लोगों के पास खाने को नहीं है, वो खुद नहीं है, बच्चों को कैसे खिलाएं, वगैरह वगैरह. दे गो इनटू अ लॉन्ग थिंग अबाउट पॉवर्टी, फूड डेफिसिट्स, हंगर, राइट? और एट द मोस्ट दे माइट गो टू द वेरी पुअर एंड इनएडिक्वेट हेल्थ केयर सिस्टम वी हैव, राइट? कि लोगों के पास डॉक्टर्स नहीं होते, रूरल हेल्थ क्लिनिक्स बड़ी बुरी हालत में है, फलाना, राइट? नाउ इज ऑल ऑफ दिस ट्रू? यस. Right? Is all of this important? Yes, right? You do need nutrition. That a very hungry brain basically needs glucose, right? We live on glucose, right? But how that glucose comes about is kind of important, right?
ओ आर एस के ग्लूकोज का पाउडर पानी में डाल के नहीं पिलाना
नहीं
है।
नहीं वो ग्लूकोज नहीं होता, वो ORS होता है. बट वी कैन कम टू ऑल ऑफ दिस. माई पॉइंट इज फूड इज इम्पोर्टेंट. ओके, सो स्ट्रेट अप, इफ यू आर एक्सट्रीमली पुअर, if you're in a food deficit situation, if you're food insecure, that's a problem. That's a serious problem. However, food deficits, caloric deficits, do not explain a 60% rural stunting rate in Sindh. 60%, over 60% in rural Sindh.
Wow.
Yeah. Two out of three children, right, are stunted in rural Sindh, all over rural Sindh. In the city of Karachi, the stunting rate is close to 30%. Even in the highest income quintile, it's a little bit close. No, sorry. The highest quintile is 28%. Overall, it's more than 40%.
In
Okay?
Karachi.
So, yes. Karachi and Hyderabad, the urban centers.
So Karachi has what, 5 million, 20 million, according to the census,
No,
that's it.
20, do be 20 to 25 million, somewhere in that
Yeah, half
vicinity.
of it
Okay.
is young, and wow, it's like over 1 million, 2 million
Oh, there
kids.
are a lot of, yeah.
Yeah,
Karachi,
wow.
because of its density, is very, half of Karachi's population lives, so to speak, in these Kachi Abadis. We don't know the exact number because it's never been done properly, but that's the claim. And we think, at any rate, a very big fraction lives in these sorts of neighborhoods where there are no services, right? So the point is that there's no way, what I was saying is that there's no way that you can explain these stunting rates, a national stunting rate of 40%, which has not moved since 1991. Right? So you cannot explain that by hunger. Extreme poverty has seriously declined during this time. Yes, we're going through a current crisis, and we can talk a little bit about that at the end. What are the implications of the last 2, 2.5 years, the 2022 floods, the rising inflation? What do we expect to see in the next mix or other surveys, right? On stunting, it's not going to be good news. But the point is that this food deficit cannot explain these stunting rates, right? It's important, but it's not just about caloric deficit. You need a nutritious and diverse diet, right? So the nutrient density of foods is quite vital, right? And this is an issue to which we pay no attention. Pakistan's the diet of infants and children in Pakistan is one of the most sort of nutritionally bankrupt diets globally. Globally, right? It's, again, we're among those countries that have the poorest dietary habits for children. Right? So there's that, right? So even if you are getting enough calories, you may be getting very poor quality calories, and that's not going to feed the brain what it needs. So there's that issue. Is healthcare important? Yes, right? If children get ill and they get an episode of diarrhea and it's untreated, right? Whether or not a child, survives or doesn't survive may depend on decent health facilities, right? So, but what else is important? So that's part of the problem. A big chunk of the problem that nobody thinks about, right? If you use the word malnutrition, no one's mind will go there.
Which I'm guilty of using in the entire introduction. So,
Not
yeah.
malnutrition is the right word, but malnutrition is an important word. It means that you're not getting enough nutrients. That does not translate into food intake. Because why? Food has to be absorbed in your system. If I intake a lot of calories and my body cannot absorb those calories, it will just come out of me unabsorbed. I will get no nutrient. Why does that happen? Because in the small intestine are these little tentacles, right? I'm going to get very little bit, into the
No,
weeds.
get in the weeds. This
But
is what we're all
we
about.
can't really have this conversation in a way without getting in the weeds, because it really needs to be understood at this level. So you have these little villi, okay? Through these villi, when you ingest food, it goes through your stomach into the small intestine, right? That is where all the nutrient absorption takes place, and through those villi, it goes through into your body and into your bloodstream, right? And your is absorbed by your cells. If those villi get damaged, they get blunted, right? That they cannot take the nutrients in from the food. So you may be getting a perfectly decent diet. Often we say, for example, in adults, they say things like, oh, you're not able to absorb X or Y, right? People have these deficits of B vitamins or things that are chronic. You sort of th think of it like that, right? So now your intestinal villi are damaged and you cannot absorb any nutrients. So your brain is starving, you may be eating, right? That child may be eating, right? What causes this? Any type of infection that hits the child's system is the child's immune system. It's a developing immune system, right? And so any type of bacterial infection, right? We typically think, at least very simply, of E. coli, which is a waterborne bacteria, but there are others. There are five or six important other ones in Pakistan. Or you get a helminth infection, right? Worms, essentially. But in either case, you have an inf your small intestine is getting damaged, right? That is not, by the way, it's you won't be sick. The child is not sick. It's not having an episode of diarrhea necessarily. So we call it subclinical, right? It's a subclinical chronic condition. This is going on all the time. The child is taking in contaminated water, contaminated with fecal matter. This is the important thing. What contamination are we worried about? We are worried a lot about fecal contamination in this environment, right? It's everywhere, right?
If I may interrupt, because you just reminded me, I mean, again, you mentioned earlier that it's in Karachi has high rates, even at the highest quintiles, it's there. I grew up in Clifton Block 8 in Karachi. A few years ago, my parents did water tests in our tank. We had E. coli, we had fecal matter, and all sorts of things that, my siblings as doctors were like, wow, this is insane. And in fact, even to this day, because of the issues with water pressure, I learned this, by the way, this year in Washington. I'll explain just how. There is a sewage smell that comes in the water. So you have to run the machine or the pump and the pipe to first smell the water. And then, of course, if the smell doesn't, that doesn't mean the stuff is not in there, but then that's your first guard. And the sewage lines are broken and the water lines are broken. So it all mixes and comes in. That's how it's happening. And this is Clifton Block 8. And I learned about this in Washington last year because you got a warning from the DC Water Authority saying that water pressure had dropped in a pipe for about an hour or so, they found out. And they said, for the next 3 days, just run your water, but don't drink it because of this issue. And I was like, ye to Karachi mein har dafa hota hai. And
Well,
nobody warns anybody about it.
you barely get 4 hours of water. There's no pressure in the pipes. That causes a lot of problems with sewage contamination, right? This issue is, in 2018, I did this report called When Water Becomes a Hazard. It was a very interesting process to write this report because I had to go through a lot of interesting conversations with my own water colleagues and health colleagues, and you were like, nahi, nahi, ye nahi ho sakta, right? Water and sanitation are not driving stunting. So we went through this internally as well, right? So ye, this attitude that acha, it's a nutrition issue, ye health walon ka masla hai, right? Your nutrition and health walon ka masla hai. None of us need to get involved in this. Things have changed completely here. But this realization was a long fight, right? To keep saying, no, look, so there's bacterial contamination in water coming right out of hand pumps. And we did water testing in 2017, in 2016. And there was bacterial contamination in water coming out of hand pumps already, right? So substrate may contamination already. Why? Because we've built all these really low quality toilets. So people's, income levels went up. They built these really low quality, single tank toilets or leachate pits or whatever in their homes. And then their toilets inside their house, open defecation went down. Great. We brought all this fecal matter right into the gullies and the neighborhoods of villages. Then it flows in open drains from their toilets through the gully and then goes into a dirty pond, right? all of that fecal matter is everywhere, and then it substrates into the ground, and then it contaminates shallow groundwater in particular. Sinka ek to ye problem hai na, groundwater levels are the water table is very high. And there's a lot of water logging and stuff. So in any case, any toilet and sink is going to be very easily contaminating groundwater sources. This mixing in cities like Karachi of sewage pipes with water pipes is endemic. In fact, I have pictures even in rural areas and small towns of water pipes running through the sewage open drains, right? With zero water pressure, as we know, right? So this business of bacterial contamination is enormous. And then there are other bacteria, waterborne bacteria, that are also very dangerous. Animal waste. You know, if you go to any rural area, you're going to see in almost every house, chicken running around in the courtyard, you know, the sort of the sehen type of area where usi area mein bache are crawling, right? You'll see them often, they'll be crawling around, especially infants. Infants have a natural behavior, we call it mouthing behaviors, right? So unko jo bhi cheez milti hai, they want to put it in their mouth. Now, if the soil were healthy, children actually ingest soil as a remedial measure to improve their microbiome. We now have learned in the last 2 decades about our microbiome and how vital it is. So children instinctively eat mud, right? Because they're trying to increase the diversity of this. It's an instinctive business. You'll often see that little babies sometimes left alone will fill their mouths with mud and sit, right? And you know, we are panicking and going like, why? I remember that when my son was
young. And now in the US, they say, let them do that, actually.
Yeah, good for them. My son was young. One day we found him, it's, you know, we'd taken him to the beach and we were sitting with his mouth full of sand and we were like, what the heck? We thought he'd choke, but it's not. They do this routinely. They will also suck on the mother's finger. They will suck on anything, on a toy, anything that they find, right? So they have mouthing, sucking behaviors. It goes on till age 2. So if there are chicken feces in the yard, if the mother did not wash her hands after dealing with the animals, you know, the household food animals and others, you know, cows, goats, sheep, whatever you have, all of that feces from animals is also going into the child's system. In fact, there are now studies that are showing that exclusively breastfed children under the age of 6 months, right, have up to 5 bacteria in their small intestines. Those bacteria are coming from where? They're coming from the mouthing behavior, from the mother's hands, right? From the floor of the wherever. And so this it's given rise to this new thing which we call baby wash, right? Which is the environmental water sanitation and hygiene conditions that are exclusively geared to the infant's behaviors, right? So even if I provide you safe water and safe sanitation, if the child is ingesting chicken feces, it's still going to be a problem, right? So it really, we need to think about that. So it's really fecal contamination writ large in the environment. So the key factor that's been missing in the conversation on stunting is these very critical environmental factors. They were dealt with through what used to be called public health, right? Public health dealt with water, with sanitation, with solid waste management, with septage treatment, right? All of that has disappeared. And, you know, we think of health now as, you know, rural health clinics, district hospitals, you know, fancy hospitals, whatever, right? Tertiary hospitals. But public health doesn't exist. There's no investment in public health. So that's one of the biggest drivers. That causes what I've been talking to you about, this subclinical infection, which we call environmental enteric dysfunction. It's a chronic condition, right? Till very recently, you had to do almost biopsy-like, you know, very invasive testing to find it. So it was done on very small samples. Now there are very simple stool tests that can be done that check for the biomarkers of environmental enteric dysfunction. We are about to do some large-scale testing. So I'll tell
you. You'll get results soon. Okay.
We'll see results. And then the other thing that we have not talked perhaps enough about is behavior change, right? So there is a component of behavior change that's important here. And that has to do with things like hand washing, as I said, right? Appropriate hand washing, safe handling of food, safe storage and reheating of food, baby wash, right? These factors are a group of, so it's all of these factors. And the big change in thinking that we are trying to bring about through these conversations on stunting is to stop thinking of it as a nutrient and healthcare issue. Right? Because people give these little chickpea biscuits to kids and they think, okay, they're taking care of the problem, or micronutrient, sort of like powders. All of this is good. But if my small intestine is damaged, the micronutrient power isn't going to do anything, or very little. I'll be generous. It'll do anything.
Yeah, I mean, I as you were explaining this, I'm into electronics, right? And I was literally, this is what is was front of me, this charger. And growing up in Karachi, often what would happen is the receptacles of the charger, the silver thing here, would get rust on it. And then no matter how good of a battery you put in, the damn thing doesn't work. And as you were explaining the small gut issue, I was thinking of that. So if this rusted, doesn't matter, you get an Energizer battery or a knockoff battery, it's not going to power the thing. So now if I were to go one level into this, right, you mentioned the behavior change and sort of what needs to happen through those interventions. And correct me, I'm just thinking out loud here, on a solvable matrix or spectrum, right? I would say, okay, Lady Health Worker Program, which Pakistan has, can be a big asset in terms of pushing through the changes that are needed to make people aware. It's not just about food, it's water, wash your hands, blah, 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 chicken feces, all of that stuff. You can send
sanitation.
You can send
sanitation.
Yeah, you can send the Lady Health Worker Program, of which the infrastructure already exists in Pakistan, to do that. How do we solve the water problem?
Exactly. So look, so right now we are also just as a closing point, I want to make one point. Pakistan-wide, even in the cities, our sewage is not treated.
Yeah.
There's no sewage treatment going on anywhere, right? It's either being dumped untreated into our canals in the rural areas, right? Our surface water systems, right, and polluting them, or is seeping into the ground and polluting the groundwater systems, or in cities like Karachi is being dumped into the ocean.
Karachi, mein toh I remember right next to the CVU McDonald's was the sewage exit right there.
You could smell it, right? You can literally smell it. So this sort of thing is, it's appalling, the kind of lack of investment that has occurred in Pakistan in this. We've totally washed our hands off the whole business of this very basic and critical service delivery.
No pun intended, Dr. Mansoori, there.
My point in one, when I gave one talk years ago when I was writing the water report, someone from, I don't know, it was UNICEF or somebody, kept talking about, hand washing and opened it. And I was like, yeah, but if you're washing your hands with bacterially contaminated water, I'm not sure exactly what that hand washing is accomplishing.
Yeah.
So wash your hands as much as you like, use the soap, and then finally rinse it all with E. coli contaminated water, right? So we have to solve this problem, right? So it's a mix of things that will do it, right? I think I see a very big role for behavior change because, behavior change does other things. For example, for the first 6 months, children should be exclusively breastfed unless the mother cannot. There are cases where you cannot. And that's is a big disadvantage, as we realize, because the entire microbiome of the child is being determined at that point. A lot of that is through mother's milk, right? Other than the birth itself. So if you're deprived of that, you have a lot of problems later, right? But sometimes it happens. You have trauma during birth, whatever, you can't. Otherwise, the child should be exclusively breastfed for 6 months, right? We're looking at the numbers right now because we're putting all the data, together against these indicators that we've developed, some 25 or so indicators on how will we track these intermediate indicators on what progress is being made towards these so that stunting can be reduced. The rate at which children are being exclusively breastfed is in urban areas, it's absolutely sad. It's around 30%. In rural areas, at best, it's 40-42%.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that the case? I mean, your conversation is like making me question a lot of assumptions I have about Pakistani society, and people still do, right? I mean, it's traditional as a society.
Yeah.
Conservative, all of that. One would, I would assume, maybe I'm totally wrong on this now that you've put the data on, but I feel,
I think our advertising has pushed, we've done a lot of, this happened in the US, right? When women went to work initially decades ago, it was pushed, oh, look how convenient it is, make a baby's bottle and go away, come back, then we realized that, oh damn, right? This stuff is really bad, right? And there's been a reversal now, so that any educated woman will want to breastfeed her child here, right? People are beginning to realize how important that is. That turnaround has not happened, right? The damage that was done in the West was beautifully transferred uninterrupted to countries like Pakistan. And basically, the people were told, formula bhata chichi se, my friend from Bangladesh, my co-colleague actually working on this, told me that there they like to feed coke to infants because they say, ye bharti product hai na, to achhi hogi na. Tang, for example, that Tang thing that we used to get in bottles, orange thing, God alone knows what's in it. But they were giving infants Tang, saying, ki ye to bahut nutritious hai, right? So these ideas through advertising, through other mechanisms, there is just no counter narrative that is actually there that you get, right? Which is, hey, this is super damaging. Nobody's explained to anybody why. It's costly, first of all. You're going and buying formula and whatever else. It's causing a mess. You have to keep the bottles clean. None of that against the simple idea that you need to really breastfeed your child for the first 6 months.
Yeah, my mother often always says, like, she whenever she visits, she's like, "Hum pehle hi theek the, pehle you all," like referring to the West, was like, broiler murgi khao or farm ka industrialized product, processed food bada acha hai, baby milk, etc. Formula. And now she's like, "Aap kehte organic khao, to hum pehle organic hi to khate the."
Well,
That's what she jokes
I
about.
grew up in Karachi eating largely organic, I now realize, right? It's all gone now because that chicken is edible. We could go on like this for like 4 hours on Pakistan, honestly.
But let me ask you, if I may, then. So we've talked about, okay, this is a sanitation issue. It's a water, it's an education bureau. Okay, we get that. Help the audience understand the implications of the scale of this challenge, right? I mean, again, you mentioned productivity, you mentioned immune. I want you to double down in particular at this combo 1-2 punch you alluded to earlier, right? Of the immune system plus climate and heat. Help the people, the listeners
Yeah,
understand what we're looking at.
I would love to, and let me complicate it further. One thing is the climate change. The other is the enormous environmental degradation that is going on in countries like Pakistan. It is more dangerous to me right now than just climate change on its own, because it literally acts, it multiplies all the impacts of climate change. When you get rain, you get floods, not because of climate change only, but because the land is so degraded, our soils are so degraded, right? That, I had some soils tested when I was writing the country climate and development report that happened a couple of years ago. And so I said, okay, let's take some plots all over Punjab. We had them tested, right? And also through geospatial data as well as ground testing. The soil quality was so low that the people at ICRAF Agroforestry who did this for me basically said that further applications of fertilizer are of no use at this point. So most of the soils that they looked at were like at 0.04, and this literally at 0.02, you're desert, right? You're going to, so they were that they're really close to desertification. So we have completely lost our biodiversity. We have extremely degraded soils. Extremely degraded soils have low productivity. Add to that what's happening with climate change. Heat will devastate crops. It'll change the monsoon cycles, right? Precipitation will become unreliable. Either you'll get floods like you're getting right now, right?
Yeah,
In
B, I was looking at a forecast. A friend sent that there's like some vortex over the GCC and Pakistan
Yeah,
coming
it's
in
a
with
big, it's
insane
a
levels of
Balochistan
rain.
and KP are going through really bad floods right now. Right? It's May almost, right? So the wheat crop is almost ready, right? So, these things happen. Either you have an extreme heat event at this time, or you have an extreme rain event at this time. These can damage our harvests. This will become more and more frequent. So I'm going back to the climate. I'll come to the productivity in a minute, but our agricultural, our food security is at enormous risk from what we've done to the environment. And with the climate change, it's only going to, there's someone I heard is a soil scientist who says, well, you are only basically 6 meals away from chaos, from societal chaos,
And
right?
on that one thing you made me think of, right? I mean, and I agree with this statement since 2022 has been made. I've made it. I've written about it. I think you may have made this as well in your writings and conversations, that Pakistan did not contribute to climate change. Absolutely true. developing country, barely any impact on CO2 emissions and what's going on. But the point you made is very important. Again, people don't acknowledge it. कि जो सॉइल के साथ खराबी हुई है, जमीन के साथ जो किया है, वो तो पाकिस्तान ने खुद किया है अपने हाथों से. And we have to acknowledge that role at least.
We have to, because not because, you know, it'll be the it's a moral thing to do, but because our survival depends on it, right? So for me,
agreed.
It's clear, right? We need to get real about agriculture. We need to get real about our environment, about our landscape restoration. We've deforested, degraded, with sort of, you know, completely decimated biodiversity. We've been destroying our water resources mercilessly, literally, right? Overusing water in the wrong places, right? Wasting water in the absolutely wrong places, right? Destroying the natural water conservation systems we had. We had a lot of natural systems for harvesting rainwater in Balochistan, in the mountains. All that is gone, right? So this degradation we did, right? And it'll probably kill us before the climate does. Right. So if we have massive climate related in the worst sort of like nightmare is massive displacement of populations because of food insecurity, it will be because of what has happened to the environment. So I think we need to get serious about this. I'm not being dramatic, like, right. I think the principal concern, and by the way, that goes right back to child stunting. You're not getting any healthy children out of a really degraded environment. Also, the nutrient density of foods, and that's what I wanted to come to, is very dependent on the quality of the soil, because plants have to absorb nutrients, which are water soluble through their roots, right? But the nutrients are not there in degraded soil. They're not available because there's no mycorrhizal fungi, there's no life in that soil, there is nothing, and we can have, like, you know, a separate conversation. It's a big one. But, you know, what's happening in the soil, the microbiome of the soil, is intimately related to our own microbiome. Both need to be fed for us to be fed, right? And so we're not feeding the ground and we're not feeding ourselves either as a result, because even you may be having an apple, but now the studies done here show that the nutrient density of those apples and pears and vegetables has fallen by 40, 50%, right? So you're taking in all these calories, you feel hungry, you're eating a lot, all of us are, but we're not getting the nutrients that we need from that, maybe getting calories, right? So that's a big issue. So coming back, so the climate has many implications for us. It's the environmental degradation combined with the uncertainty it's going to create, right? So we are starting to get more precipitation than normal, that region, right? And as the glaciers melt and so forth, we'll also get unseasonable. So it'll all fall as rainfall rather than as snow, because the temperature in the north is going to warm up. When that happens, you may get a lot of water, right? And if you don't know how to store that water when it does come, right? Or your ground is, in other words, you don't have in-ground water reservoirs, which is what we need. Healthy soil is basically just an in-ground water reservoir. It keeps enormous quantities of water safely locked away so that if there are drought conditions, it has water. Plants will still grow, right? So you think of like massive in-ground water reservoirs, that's what a healthy soil is. It's extremely porous. It holds an enormous amount of, you know, air pockets in which water can go get stored.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's spring right now and I'm an amateur gardener in spring.
Oh, I am too.
Months.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so I was going to say, for people who are listening, who actually want to test this out, you can get two sort of planters, gamle. In one, you put clay soil, which is eroded soil or not high quality soil, and pour a gallon of water or a liter of water in that planter. And at the same time, get good khad from your gardener or from a local supplier. Put that in the second planter and put a liter of water, and you will notice exactly what Dr. Mansoori is talking about in terms of absorption capability and flow capability, and how the worst soil will basically get waterlogged and the water will stay on top, whereas good quality khad will absorb it and actually it won't leach out from the bottom even.
Wonderful example. And imagine that water that's sitting on top, what happens to it? It basically, when it moves, it takes all the topsoil with it. So, and it makes the, it kills all the bacteria and the life under the soil, because that space becomes anaerobic. There's no oxygen coming when water is standing, right? So it's a very devastating situation. So this child health issue to me is intimately related, right, with what's coming, right? Both because weak populations are going to be unable to bear what's coming, right? And secondarily, our food and nutrient, our food security is at risk, to be honest. So, you know, water security is at risk. But there's another thing I wanted to say on this, which is also related to climate, which is that, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, how important macro, sorry, talk about climate, but I want to come back to macro and then to climate. So we did some, we did a basic policy simulation when we were writing the climate report on what kind of impact just dealing with child stunting and reducing, and we haven't talked about fertility yet, which is really important. I wanted to come in on that from the health angle also. Pakistan's fertility rate is at 3.2-ish right now. All of the region, all of our own region is at replacement. So close to 2.0, heading sort of even south of that now, right? In Bangladesh and India. Now that means that we basically have to support a bigger and bigger population of unhealthy people, right? That's very scary to me.
On degraded soil in an environment of climate change.
I mean, it's horrific, you know. Sometimes it like literally keeps me awake at night. People use this word, it keeps me awake at night, but honestly, it sometimes literally keeps me awake at night, right? Because people are just so complacent about it. It's like, haan kar lenge, you know, macro stability le aate, ye kar lete, right? It's like, you know, you're sitting on a powder keg here, right? And when it comes, it'll come fast. And I want to go back to what I said. If you're 6 meals or 8 meals away from societal chaos, right? And you have failed harvests and you cannot feed people, right? Then you're talking, you're not talking about a stable society in any case, right? So I think it's very important to absorb all of that. This experiment that we did, we showed that just by getting Pakistan's fertility rate to replacement, not a huge ask, the rest of the region is already there, right? And dealing with the water and sanitation part of what's driving stunting, right? You increase GDP growth by very substantial numbers. Already by 2040, you would get a 6% boost to GDP and per capita GDP, of course, much more because you're reducing fertility at the same time. By 2050, you get a 12% increase. If I remember the numbers correctly, sorry, they're not in front of me, but it's huge, right? It's in the policy note actually that I shared with you, right? So that first graph, right? So these numbers are huge in terms of the GDP growth impact alone. If you want to do something for growth, you know, you could be doing this, right? So, and then you asked me another question earlier, which is, you know, hum kya kar sakte hain, right? So water sanitation, and people say it's bahut costly hoga, right? So basically we are wasting incredible amount of money, okay, every year, on really bad subsidies that do not help poor people, right? That go to all the wrong people for all the wrong reasons, right?
Well, $17.5 billion a year, according to the UNDP on elites alone.
$17.5 billion for a minute, right? How much do you need? You need to fix this water, this complete, safely managed water, safely managed sanitation, right? With waste, proper waste disposal, all sewage treated, all water treated, you need about 4 billion a year for 15 years. This is the capex I'm talking about. We fix things for 50 years ahead after that. The GDP boost alone would more than pay for it, right? What is it? It's about roughly 1% of your GDP. It says it's a 350, depending on whether GDP is going up or down, roughly, okay? About 1% of your GDP is what you have to invest per year for this enormous, enormous benefit, right? 17.5 billion, as you said, are going into various emoluments, right? And then, of course, we've even talked about the actual subsidies, which are another few billion a year, right? On nonsense, right? So in my mind, when someone tells me Pakistan doesn't have money, I just want to laugh, right? Because the issue is not that we don't have money. The issue is that we're finding every possible way to spend money badly that any country possibly could, right? There's no need, I mean, so focus, I mean, there's, you know, even the macro crisis is manufactured, as we know, right? So it's just makes you sad because, you know, this is the right of people living in a society. I'm really sorry, but these are issues of rights, you know, to provide safely managed water, to provide safely managed sanitation, to take care of your bio, of the environment you've been given. These are, you know, this should be counted as basic human needs and rights. In fact, they are, right? Food security, water security, right? How can we sit around and say, oh, you know, this is a luxury. We'll get to it when we get to it. Abhi aap log jo hai, thoda sa behavior change kar le, right?
आई मीन लग्जरी जिनके पास है उनके पास भी ईरकोलाई और फीसीज वाला पानी दैट्स द ट्रेजेडी राइट आई मीन क्लिफ्टन एंड डिफेंस इज नॉट पुअर पीपल्स
Yeah.
प्लेसेस
You raise a great point on that front because this is one of those environmental conditions. I went to Karachi after it had rained, I think was maybe last year, maybe the year before. I remember it was Augustish. The whole city smelled of sewage. 2 inches of rain padi ho gaya, which it wasn't a flood, right? The entire city smelled of sewage. And then someone took me to brunch somewhere in that area around Clifton, you know, Kekashan type area. Very nice breakfast place, right? Right outside it was an open sewage. And I was like looking at it going like, how are we going to go inside and eat breakfast now? Because this thing smells really bad. It's right outside this really high-end restaurant. People have just become so indifferent to what is like happening right around them. It's stunning to me, right? Ke 2 inch rain padi, pura the whole city is smelling of sewage, right? A city like Karachi is our biggest city, like commercial center, all of that. So my point is, it's completely unnecessary, right? You cannot claim that you cannot spend 1% of your GDP for a limited period of time, right? To take care of the capital costs that are needed, to deal at least with the environmental. We still have to fix our health system, but then we have to fix the agri-food system. And that's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
It's another passion in life, right? But we have to fix the agri-food system. And we talk a little bit about that. We have to restore soils. We have to restore our biodiversity. So we have nutritious, reliable food. Right. Then we've got, so those are the things we need to do, essentially. Right. And of course, there's a role for lady health workers and health, other types of health workers and so forth, both for behavior change, but also providing, you know, you still need the antenatal care. You still need the postnatal care. You still need safe delivery. And anecdotally, I'll tell you one very interesting thing and stop. Pakistan is the country where the most babies are born in facilities. We've been massively increasing facility-based births. It is also the country with the highest infant mortality.
Yeah, that's another figure Dr. Atif Mia gives consistently, that the trauma caused just by that. And like, you know, it's just insane.
But it's also understandable. Bangladesh and India have lower facility births, higher child survival rates. We've been pushing facility-based births. What's going on in those facilities? Probably they're completely contaminated, in my view, for one thing.
Yeah.
I think people get bacterial and other infections when they go in there. But, you know, we have a very unusually high infant mortality rate.
So I'll tell you, I mean, like this, the contamination part, I won't name the hospital, but it's a fancy hospital in Karachi. And a friend of mine worked in that ecosystem of like building hospitals. So he was doing surveys. And he told me, like, never go to that hospital. And I was like, why? He's like, because when I did the HVAC system analysis, they don't have the right type of filters and the ventilation done. So you're at a higher risk, even if you're in the ICU, you're at a higher risk of catching an infection. So I was saying this to my sister. And I shared this with my sister. And she says, no, now it all makes sense.
Ah, okay, good. You unfroze. You're just frozen for a second. That's fine.
No, I was saying that I tell this to my sister, who's a doctor, and she was at that point in Pakistan. And she goes, now it all makes sense. And I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, it's because when I was doing my residency and training, a lot of the patients came from this hospital with all sorts of infections, and we always wondered why. And now that your friend has told you it's the ventilation system problem, I understand it makes complete sense how people were catching infections because the ventilation was terrible. So everybody's comfortably sitting in an AC, but they don't know get Neora cleaning. You mentioned, I want to ask about this, right? You mentioned Bangladesh, India, lower facilities, etc. You are at the World Bank. You look at a lot of other case studies, etc. What are some countries like in the same sort of developmental trajectory like Pakistan? And what have they done to solve for like stunting, water, environment, things that you know and we just talked about need to be solved for? Where can we learn things from?
So that's a good question. So I'll give you the history first. So just tracking data from when we have it, when we have consistent data, roughly around the 1990 point, we have consistent data. Peru and China in 1990 had exactly the same stunting rate as Pakistan, around 40%. 41, 42, somewhere there. So Peru is right now at 12.2. China is at 4.8. China was
Wow.
a country till very recently. Very recently. I went to China, in fact, not that long ago. If you go to rural China up in the mountains, you sort of realize that it was only yesterday when they were very poor. You can still see the remnants of that, right?
I mean,
So,
China's GDP per capita in 1990 was lower that than of Pakistan's.
and their stunting rate was about the same as ours. 4.8 is their stunting rate today. Ours is still stuck at 40, right? Peru was roughly the same. Now, there were countries like Bangladesh, which started at something like 70, maybe 73, 74%, much higher than. So East Pakistan's stunting rates back then, much higher than West Pakistan. And there, you know, there really were issues with food insecurity, serious issues of food insecurity. But they have worked on all of this, right? And they've done a lot of community-based water and sanitation, right? What they call, I think it's called community-based total sanitation. It's not fully safe water and sanitation, but it's just improving behaviors and safety issues around water, treating water, so forth. Bangladesh's current rate is somewhere around 30, 31, 32%, right? So they've halved their stunting rate. Pakistan's stunting rate has actually gone up. It's the only country
Wow.
that has gone up by 10 or 11% between 1991 and today. I'm telling you, look at the numbers for Sindh. They're scary. It's 2 out of 3 children in rural Sindh, okay? Almost half the children in urban Sindh, right, are stunted. And nothing explains this. It's insane. So it's a total public health failure, right? Zero investment in providing water safely, zero investment. Whatever little people have done, they've done on their own. And I show this in the WASH report, right? All of the investments made in water and sanitation in rural Pakistan have been made, 99% of them have been made by individual households themselves. You know, tube well laga diye hain, hand pumps laga diye hain logon ne, se wo pani le rahe hain. And they've put these low quality toilets, right? Just say, well, look, they've sort of tried to get away from open defecation. Bas, itna hi hua hai. There's no public system, jahan pe open drains hai, NGOs have done them. Little bit has been done by the public sector, mostly through village efforts, right? Open drains into what used to be clean ponds, right? For what we call water polishing, that's what they were intended for. So that, you know, you send clean water there and then and rain water, storm drains, wagaira. Those have become, if you go to any village, stagnant ponds, right? That have sewage water essentially. So it's a very unhappy start, but it's solvable, right? There are a few things in the world that do not require some high level of technology we don't have, right? This environmental stuff is solvable, right? We can fix the soil, we can fix the landscapes that we've destroyed. We can address water and sanitation, right? These are things we can do. We're not waiting for you know, we don't have to wait for green hydrogen or, you know, carbon capture and storage or anything. We don't need to worry about that stuff. Don't mitigate, right? Just do this. You'll mitigate anyway because, you know, water and sanitation is a huge source of emissions, and so is degraded land essentially, because
Yeah.
all carbon leaking out from these degraded soils every year with plowing and all this fertilizer. We haven't even talked about the impact of nitrates on child stunting, this excessive use of fertilizer and the fertilizer runoff into our water systems, right? The pesticide runoffs into our.
उसपे भी बड़ी जबरदस्त सब्सिडी दी जाती है फर्टिलाइजर पे.
Fertilizers, pesticides, har galat cheez pe, as far as I can tell, right? You know, it's these are easily reversible subsidies, right? And you can, all you have to do is talk to people carefully about them, that look, they're not benefiting poor people. They're not even benefiting the middle class, right? So, you know, the huge swath of this population should be behind you when you remove these subsidies. If
Yeah.
we did the narration correctly, okay, kahan ja rahe? And you know, we're doing all the numbers on this now, so we will have all of this very clear. We do some of it in the climate report, but you know, it can be made perhaps a little clearer. Wheat procurement certainly does not benefit anybody, right? There's this whole myth that wheat procurement farmers ke liye achhi hoti hai, but you know, small farmers are not benefiting from wheat procurement.
No, in fact, like months ago, I had Adil Mansoor, who's a researcher on the ag side for Business Recorder. And he had the data at that point showing that The Punjab government, in fact, borrows to pay interest on the commodity purchases, particularly wheat, that it does.
Years out of the wheat procurement system are commercial banks, actually.
Yeah, that was exactly his point. I want to sort of, you said that these are solvable, not rocket science. The world has done it. Peru's done it. China's done it. Bangladesh, which was worse shaped than Pakistan, has opted
Uganda, and
pretty.
it was devastatingly poor, already fixed it years ago, perhaps among the first countries.
So I want to sort of like, obviously it's April 22 when we're recording this. In a month and a half or so, the budget will be out. One thing that I often like, I'm a bit, maybe over time I've become cynical, maybe I'm getting older. I'm just like, don't throw money at the problem, but money always is important, right? You need resources, you need to employ people, buy the right technology, invest, make the right projects, et cetera. If you were to sort of look at the upcoming budget season at the provincial level, at the federal level, right? You said that it's a total failure. They've washed their governments have washed successively washed their hands off of this problem. What would you look for if I were to say two to three things that you were like, Dr. Mansoori, budget aa gaya hai, isme ye teen cheezein hain, and you would say ke acha chalo ek step right direction mein lena shuru kar diya hai. What would those tangible things be?
I don't think anything that I would consider important is going to happen, to be honest. But let's not be cynical, right? As I said, we need to immediately start investing in two things. One is the public health system, which means water, safely managed water, safely managed sanitation. It is not too much to ask for. We're not asking for any luxuries for poor people, right? This is necessary. It has to be done. It has to be done for our own growth potential. Because as I said, it's absolutely silly to expect the country to grow sustainably in the face of this kind of these kinds of levels and this type of challenge. Number one, we need to do that. And number two, we need to get down to the business of taking very seriously the issue of the agri-food system that we have built, right? It's an extremely polluting, extremely low productivity, right? Inequitable system. Inequitable because of the nonsense subsidies, polluting because of all the inputs we are using, and extremely costly. So farmers, small farmers cannot keep this up. They're being told to dump purchased fertilizer, purchased seeds, purchased pesticides onto land that cannot be productive. Right? And growing what? Five of the, five crops, none of which, other than maybe we need wheat and rice to consume to some degree, but they're calorically cereals. What about the rest? Where is the nutritious and diverse diet? Right? We're growing five crops that are, some of which are extremely ridiculously water thirsty, sugarcane, rice. I mean, we really shouldn't be in that zone, be doing that. And sugarcane, what is it? It's basically sugar. It's not a calorie. It's not a useful thing to be producing. Yes, maybe for taste you have to produce some. People like it, but we don't have to subsidize and protect it, So I would look for, if you ask me what I would look for personally, I want to see what is happening on environmental issues. And there are two types: public health and on the agri-food system. And equally, I don't work on the sector, but I think it's absolutely foundational what's happening to basic schooling. I'm not talking about tertiary schooling, right? If I were to do one thing, I would say just make it mandatory to go to school at least. I don't even care if the schools are terrible, right? You have to get compliance up at least, right? We have the largest number, I think, of out-of-school children perhaps anywhere in the world now. So these things are unforgivable. It's always good to be hopeful, but if I was looking, I'd look for that.
Another question on this, right? Again, so that's the government policy intervention or what the government should prioritize. And I agree with you. A lot of my audience are young, under 35, right? So by essence, either they are or about to be parents. And if you're living in Pakistan and you are living in that environment, guess what? It's not going to improve in the near future. So how would you advise, like, again, from your experience, like young parents who are planning to have a family, to what should they be? What are the interventions they can do at the household level to make sure that those first 1,000 days where we began our conversation are spent in a way where they're to be child, and then the young baby grows up to be healthy?
So for any household, I would start with already pay a lot of attention to adolescent girls, right? A lot of adolescent girls are coming into marriage and their first pregnancy anemic. Potentially, if they were not stunted, then at least with a lot of infections in their system, weak systems, that's already when they get pregnant going to be causing a problem. The second is diet during pregnancy is very important. The, antenatal care visits, getting yourself checked for infections, making sure you don't have anemia, right? All of that stuff is going to matter, right? Your audience is going to be largely urban as well, right? So they will have better access anyway. The two people truly at risk are the bottom two quintiles, sitting in rural areas. They're the people truly at risk. Second thing is you can in the interim, while we don't have safe water systems, you can treat your water, right? At point of use. Boiling water will kill bacteria, right? So at least for the infant, there should be no unboiled water being used, at least for the infant. Exclusively breastfeed, right? As long as you can, as literally as long as you can. I mean, up to a point, obviously, right? Certainly 6 months, absolutely. And after that, as much as possible till age one, right? You have to introduce other foods, but that's another thing you can do. Treat your water. Practice the right hand washing. It's really important. And wash those hands with clean water, right? So no point in washing your hands with bacterially contaminated water. Ideally, put some sort of, if you're urban, you can get filter systems. You can use filtered water. But at least for the first 1,000 days of that child's life, be very, very careful of what you're ingesting, what that child is ingesting, right? What the child is taking in through their mouthing behaviors, the ground that they're playing on, all of that stuff, right? It's possible to do, particularly for an educated mother, right? To be able to enforce these things, and father, obviously. So I would say be very careful in the first 1,000 days. Certainly, of course, the child probably will get healthcare, ORS. Those things have become very common now. But I would do those four, five key things, right? And that can go a long way, right? In helping to keep a child safe. But you really have to see that that is the period, right? If your 3-year-old is exposed, there's less, there's, that stunting piece is at least done. They may get sick. They may get worms or deworming. That's another thing people can do. Make sure your child gets dewormed. And you have to do it after age one and before age 2 months. Right? So that at least the helminth infection issue, which is, by the way, quite, we say that people have used to claim that it isn't a lot in Pakistan. I don't think that's true. Because in humid climates, of course, it's much more. You get a lot more. I think a lot of kids have worms. And we are not testing for that possibly, probably, and we're not deworming. It's one of the cheapest interventions there is to do. It's safe, it's cheap, it's really nothing, and yet we're not doing it. Shockingly, vaccination rates. You would have thought that by now vaccination would be at 80, 90% in Pakistan, given all that we hear about these massive vaccination campaigns. It's devastating. The data for Sindh today from the 2018 mix showed a 30% vaccination rate. 30%. How I don't even know how to like deal with that,
I
data.
feel it's gotten worse actually, because I remember again, like my schooling years in or in Karachi, and there would be vaccine campaigns in school. And now when I hear from my friends or cousins who have children, it doesn't happen as often as, and we all wonder, we're all like, yaar, hum jab bade ho rahe the, tab to it was a big thing in the school ke lagna hi aapko to vaccine.
And now you're talking about a high-income neighborhood in a big metro center, right? Usme ye halat hain ab ke, we are not seeing. I think even the Karachi's vaccination rate is around 60, 70, 60%, 70%. I think if I'm not wrong.
Stalled. It just like I, you can see, people talk about it now. They just say it's not the same.
Happening is that bachche jo kachchi abadiyon mein hain, wo nahi ho rahe vaccinate, right? Or jo rural areas mein unka to pata nahi Sindh mein ho kya raha hai. I don't know what's going on. How can you have a 30% vaccination rate? Sindh has a 40% open defecation rate. Right? I mean, honestly, I don't know how to. It's unforgivable. In
No,
my
and I mean it's like since, I mean we're not talking politics today, but that's what annoys me the most is that you have a ruling regime in the province for a number of years now, and they aspire to rule the country. And I'm like, boss, show me what you've done with the province at least.
That's all I want to see. I want to see the you know, I see the statistics of sin, you know, having been grown up there like you. I grew up in Karachi, right? I did my PhD dissertation work in rural Sindh. I love the place, but it has become a nightmare. It has progressively, it was never great, you know. I remember when I was doing all my work with tenants and landlords, it was a horror show. You know, there were these private prisons. I went to all of those things and saw them, right? Tenant situation was just out of control, right? The landlords would show up and steal people's harvest right at the time of harvest. All this was there. But now you're going to see problems of extreme stunting, right? So we say minus, you know, not to get techie, but minus two standard deviations, we say stunted. But I think we're going to see minus three standard deviation type stuff, right? A friend of mine was claiming that. I'm about to do a very large scale survey in Sindh under this. We're doing some work on post-flood reconstruction monitoring. So we'll see. We'll be doing child anthropology.
And for those on the audience who are not super familiar with stats, the minus one to minus two standard deviation is not the same as minus two to minus three standard deviation. It's very important to understand that people think ek se do chale gaya, do se teen. It's not the same. It's not linear.
Not linear, folks. Right? Exactly. So you know, yeah. It's just ununderstandable, right? So vaccination rates ko dekh lo, child mortality rates ko dekh lo, kuch bhi, any statistic you pick up, you're just like, what? You know, what is going on? You know, so this is to me, I in one word, I personally, for me, this is unforgivable.
No, I fully agree with you, and I think it's one of those things that you mentioned this, and I want to end the conversation before I get your book recommendations on this exact point, right? We are currently, for the last 5 years at least, but over Pakistan's history, obsessed with in the search of macroeconomic stability. Wo nahi ho sakti jab tak ye haal hai aapke mulk mein, because macro micro se banta hai, or micro level pe you are inflicting intergenerational trauma on your people. How do you?
So-called micro issues, micro nahi hai, yehi macro issues hai, right? Your entire population. And by the way, we didn't talk about one thing. Imagine now the public health cost that we're going to be facing. Because as these people are becoming adults, Pakistan is globally among the countries with the highest rate of diabetes, massive rates of blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. So we've acquired all of these chronic diseases while, you know, the old kind of infectious diseases are still running rampant. So you're going to be facing a massive health bill. What is that going to do to growth?
Yeah. And you did not add this, but since we're on there already, you have one of the worst air pollution in South Asia.
Yes. The environmental degradation, right? That we did, right? Air pollution wasn't done by climate change. That we accomplished all on our own, right? So I think this kind of taking a little bit of responsibility, not because, as I said, for anyone else, but because, you know, one's own survival depends on it for that reason, right? People need to care about it because their survival and their children's survival depends on all of these things, right? Not to make a global point about humne nahi kiya tha climate, kya nahi kiya tha, agreed.
Nay, and I mean, I think the hopeful point on this is, right, that Mother Nature has a very robust healing quality to it. And I think of it like, as I do, you know, when doing research on this, like the Clean Air Act in America, the rivers in America that used to get set on fire, they fixed it.
Exactly. And there was no, you know, they were fixed at a time when fossil fuel use was going up. Okay. So it's totally fixable. It's totally fixable. The environmental issues, the on the ground issues, totally fixable. Don't need new technology. They just need, you know, the conviction. Look at the solutions. They exist. Others are doing it, right? I mean, fixing the agri-food system is certainly a low-cost business, relatively speaking, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to pay for all these fertilizers, pesticides, whatever, right? There are low-cost ways of doing this.
Yeah. No, fully agree. All right. This has been a great, great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. I'm glad we finally managed to connect and do this recording. Before I let you go, you know this question. I see some books in the background as well. What are two or three books you would recommend to the audience?
Oh, I was thinking about that because you asked me, and I thought, you know, the only thing I'm reading these days, and really very deeply in, is on agri-food systems. So I wanted to recommend a couple of things. One is there's this guy who was writing actually in the early 20th century, believe it or not. There's a book actually right here by him. This is Albert Howard. I have it here, so I'll show it to you. I have to put it here to show it to you. It's called An Agricultural Testament, and this one is called The Soil and Health. Okay, so this guy was a British guy who was sent to undivided India to go and tell farmers what to do to fix productivity because the British wanted to extract more from the soil. And he came and he found, he said, "Hey, these guys know what they're doing." Going back to you, what your mother was saying to you, right? He said, I'm seeing incredibly healthy, diverse, pest-free systems that are really turning, in some cases, very poor soils into extremely high productive soils, right?" So he wrote back, and he wrote this book called this book is called An Agricultural Testament, was the first book he wrote, came out in 1940. Then he wrote this one, The Soil and Health, a study of organic agriculture, which has become really the founding Bible for the shift, the organic movement in the West, right? This was what we practiced all over Asia, including he worked in Quetta. He looked at all of these systems, beautiful books, by the way, right? He looked at all the kind of water harvesting and all of the stuff they were doing with mulching, with integrating orchards with vegetable production to get yields out of very poor soils in very stable ways over centuries. There's another book which I didn't put in this list, but I'm now that I'm thinking about it, which people should also look at, is called Farmers of 40 Centuries, right? That takes the sort of the East Asian landscape, right? And then there's a final book I want to talk about, which is very recent, which is by this guy, David Montgomery, and that is called Dirt. The actual title is Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. And that traces the history of how cultures, societies, empires have risen and fallen on what they have done to their soil and environment. Way before climate change ever happened, right? Entire civilizations got wiped out
Yeah.
with the way they did their agriculture and managed their land. So these are also beautiful reads, guys, is what I want to say, right? It's not just that they will blow your mind, right? They will blow your mind, but on top of that, they are almost poetically beautiful to read. He's a very good writer. Howard's a beautiful writer, and so is David Montgomery.
Yeah.
So I really strongly suggest starting with these books.
I'll check those out because the first one that, you know, as you were talking about the diversity of the food system that was built over. It's fascinating. And in fact, Obaid Zubair, who's a dear friend of mine, he's been on the podcast. He owns this food company in northern Pakistan called Shazde. And he was on the podcast. And once we were chatting and he was talking about how, you know, there's obviously an issue with dairy farming and estrogen. And he was like, if you actually look at do the research, he had done some research. That this was not a problem in the dairy industry in the Indian subcontinent because something, I forget what exactly he was talking about, but some crop was grown around dairy farms and the human beings would eat it as well as the cows. And that crop naturally had a estrogen reduction impact in the dairy industry of that time. And then when monoculture set in, you got rid of that because it wasn't considered a cash crop. So your diet became mono as well as the diet of the cow, and now estrogen is up. And so he was like, well, the solution to that is not more drugs to the cow for reducing estrogen. It's just that you look at what old farmers used to raise, introduce that crop again, and put that into the feed.
I'm not aware of the estrogen issue, but there's a major issue with methane
Yeah.
and the methane emissions that so-called we're all supposed to stop eating meat because there's you know and so someone wrote a book I think called It's Not the Cow, It's the How. And basically it's like when animals are on diverse landscapes and eating they eat 20, 30 different types of grasses, right? And cumulatively, those have the higher nutrition content. And so pasture-raised cow beef we're now seeing
Yeah.
is high in omega-3s. It's the kind of fat we should be getting, right? So it's otherwise meat is omega-6, right? It's not that good for you to have too much of it. So, you know, these things are literally things we knew how to do, as you're saying, right? We grew the right type of fodder crops for the animals. The animals grazed on fodder. Animals were integrated with agriculture. There was no monocropping, right? So I think that these, so I hope some people will get inspired to read some of these books because they
Yeah.
are beautiful reads.
No, and it's just lost knowledge, right? And again, I'll double check what exactly he was talking about, but it's related to this entire regen, what is now referred to as regenerative agriculture.
That's right.
Okay, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. Again, it was a pleasure talking to you, learning more. And again, I hope that more people pay attention to these topics because, yeah, as we both agree, and I'm more on the econ side. You're also on the econ side. Not different. I often talk about macro stability, but we agree that macro stability cannot be had with all these issues. So hope people try to solve for it. It's solvable. That's the hopeful point here. But again, thank you so much for your time.
Talking to you, Zed.
Thank you.